Welcome to the Not Unreasonable Podcast. I'm your host, David Wright, an actuary and reinsurance broker. This is a show of interviews with people who have something to teach us about managing our businesses and ourselves. There's a lot to learn out there, folks, so let's get to work. This show is brought to you by Beach, where I work and have worked my entire career. We are a global reinsurance intermediary, and we pride ourselves on creative thinking, deep analysis, and client service. Those three qualities are actually intimately related because you can't spend the energy digging deep into a problem unless you really care about the client. We find that when you really do understand the problem, the solution becomes obvious, even if it seems a little bit unorthodox to the outside world at first. The nature of insurance is to take solutions we know and trust and try to force them onto the problems of the day. We just don't settle for that. You can see further at beachgp.com. Before we get started today, folks, a quick disclaimer from my guest, Jim Weiss.
Everything we're going to discuss just reflects my opinions and observations and not those of anyone else, such as my employer, ISO.
My guest today is Jim Weiss. Jim is the Director of Analytics Solutions for ISO, where he helps develop and implement the ISO Risk Analyzer suite of predictive modeling products and services. Mr. Weiss is also leading new efforts to use social media and wellness analytics in property casualty insurance. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
So I've seen articles and talks from you as a booster, I would call it, of big data and analytics services, but also occasionally giving what I would think of as kind of a sober warning against how actually this sort of work is harder than it looks. And most of the it's an interesting contrast to a lot of the press that I will read or some of the articles that I'll read, which are just unalloyed enthusiasm for big data. So what I'm wondering is whether you think the big data analytics, telematics, whether these are overrated or underrated by the insurance community.
I think if you were going to write a history of big data in insurance ending today, I would probably have to say that maybe big data in insurance has been a little bit overrated. I mean, if you look at our industry in recent years, I think it's kind of a graveyard of big data analytics type projects that went over budget, over deadline. And I think there are a lot of factors contributing to that, but they can largely be characterized as maybe we're not doing these projects very well, but moreover, we're not picking these projects very well. But luckily, and this is in large part driven by our profession, I think we can change both of those things. I think there's still a lot of the story left to be written, and ultimately I feel it will be a success story.
Is there a most common error pitfall? Is it an error in conception or is it an error in execution? So by that I mean, are we pointing it at the wrong things or are we going after the right kind of stuff but doing it in the wrong way?
My personal opinion is sometimes, not everybody, but some of us are pointing at the wrong things. And I look at it as, gosh, you know, are we looking at some really wicked problems and trying to find data to solve them? Or are we looking at some really wicked data and trying to find problems to solve? And oftentimes it's a little bit more of the second one.
And do you mean wicked problems in the formal sense?
I don't mean in the formal sense, but you certainly could apply it in the formal sense. I think
right. There
are a lot of wicked problems like a protection gap that can be solved through more prudent use of analytics. But I meant it more generally.
Right. Okay. So really difficult problems to solve. And I'm wondering about what sort of problems, if you have an example of a problem which is difficult that we think analytics is great on, but it maybe shouldn't be tackled in that way. Something come to mind?
Well, in a general sense, I mean, you mentioned telematics.
Yeah,
and that's
sure. Something
I look at as we first started talking about as early as the late 90s. And a lot of discussion and debate has been geared since then towards trying to predict when exactly the tipping point for telematics was going to happen, when it was going to go mass market.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it still hasn't gone mass market in insurance, although there have been a lot of interesting use cases applied in our industry. But there have been a couple of niche efforts that I find really compelling that are really geared towards solving specific problems, like the fact that insurance at times can be unaffordable in certain areas. And making that insurance more affordable, particularly for low mileage operators, or solving the problem that ride sharing operators previously may have needed a fairly complex patchwork of policies to cover their risk management needs, but instead using a smartphone to provide a single risk management solution. So for me, telematics may be something that hasn't quite hit the mark just yet, but we're seeing some really focused point solutions that are actually solving problems using data and analytics.
Now you wrote a paper a few years ago, which I read, which was focus on telematics was with Smolik, was it the gentleman's name?
Yes, my teammate Jared Smolik at ISO.
Right. And so I thought that was a great
it was designed to be an introduction to telematics paper, I think, as how it was conceived. And it was a great paper. It was one of the references in that paper I found fascinating, which was a paper by Connors and Feldblum, which was written in the early 90s and made this distinction that I thought was really useful. And it's maybe I was thinking about it ever since I read it, which is between pre-accident and post-accident factors for auto insurance. And so one of the observations they made was auto insurance tends to be rated on pre-accident factors, so characteristics that don't have anything to do with the accident. We don't know what happened yet, so demographics, age, vehicle type, symbol, as they call it. But then the thing that probably really drives the loss are the post-accident factors. And there's an interesting, in that being kind of the severity of the claim, legal environment, that sort of thing, how bad was the accident, and whether there are lawyers involved. Now, one of the really interesting observations about the paper was that there is one particular instance of a pre-accident factor that we think is about the quality of the risk, but it's actually a post-accident factor, that being territory. So territory we think of as, oh, if you're in the Northeast, you get more ice storms, for example. But actually territory really means you have a better or worse legal jurisdiction. So we misattributed the predictive power of what we thought was a pre-accident factor and as actually a post-accident factor. Probably in a little while since you read that paper, but if I got that right, what do you think about that as an observation from that paper?
I would go with that from two different angles. I think specifically regarding your territory observation, I've worked with a number of territory models where we use various different types of data sources to form a really precise prediction of the risk, things like geodemographic data, weather data, elevation data. But oftentimes in those models, one of the most significant variables is just empirical insurance premium and loss experience. So you can never really get away from that. And I think that's attributable in large part to the fact that some things just can't be characterized objectively.
Sure.
But as to the larger discussion of like pre-accident versus post-accident factors, I think you can generalize that certainly beyond auto. And as you're looking at bigger and bigger data, sensor data, data that's coming through in real time, you're really going from prediction to observation. And you're almost approaching something that I would call like highly sophisticated experience rating. And there's nothing wrong with that. But how sophisticated can you get when it comes to experience rating when you're looking at what's the credibility of an individual risk? That's why I think with some of these bigger data sources, when you're just looking at prediction, when you're just looking at trying to find the perfect price point, there's always a place for that in a competitive market. But maybe as actuaries and as an industry, we should be a smidge more creative in envisioning how we use this data for the ultimate benefit of our organizations, our policyholders, and society.
Sophisticated experience rating. That's interesting. And of course, that's what actuaries do, is look at the experience. And as I forget who made this joke, but actuaries, there's a lot of hoopla, but really all we're doing is linearly extrapolating the trend, which we might analyze very carefully. Do you get more, I guess the term of art is lift, from a more sophisticated experience rating? Because one of the things that I wonder about is overfitting. Right. So really sophisticated experience rating might just be really, really tailoring your model to the data set. And then do you know that you've done anything more, or is it just a lot more code?
I mean, from my perspective on many of the projects I've worked on, I would say the vast majority you do see pretty significant what you refer to as loss ratio lift when you're introducing new information, new data in pricing. Not all the time, but most of the time. But what I've also seen is there really should be an onus on keeping those models current because they do become very affixed or overfit, as you described it, to a particular point in time. We did a survey at ISO with a partner organization where we asked a bunch of analytics professionals how often they upkeep their models, how often they refresh them, how often they revisit some of the assumptions. And many of them were doing this as recently as, you know, once every year or two, which is awesome. But some weren't even doing it any more frequently than every 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. And the further you get from that point in time where you were relating all these external data factors to the actual premium and loss experience, the more tenuous those predictions become, and the more that model risk just starts to increase at quite a steady rate.
I studied a few years ago. So actually before I think I seriously got into the actuarial exams, I was doing some self-taught programming courses, right? Coursera. And I came across this amazing technique, which I remain incredibly disappointed I have yet to see in the syllabus. I mean, it probably is somewhere now, but it certainly hasn't been through my education. And that is the idea of a holdback data set, right? So you have a cross-validation process. So that's like you fit your model on 2/3 of the data and you hold back the 1/3 as as a test to say, how good's my model? Because otherwise you have this problem of overfitting, and it's really the only way to test for overfitting. And it's not discussed in the actuarial literature. I mean, the typical actuarial model will say, let's take all the years and we'll fit a model and then we'll just hope next year works, as opposed to saying, well, how good does the model up until 2015 predict 2016, and here we are in 2018, and now we have confidence that 2018 is going to work. What do you think about that? Why don't we have holdback data sets?
You know, I listened to your last podcast with Kathy, and she made a really good point, which you guys were discussing, which is how the heck do you know these models are working?
And, yeah, right. Exactly.
You point out a best practice, which I've seen utilized in the vast preponderance of projects I've worked on, which is keeping a holdout data set to sort of keep an independent check that your models are doing what you think they're doing, that the performance isn't deteriorating significantly when you generalize to a new data set. But there are various different ways you can go at that and increase your level of confidence, one of which is just sort of randomly holding out a data set and then testing that a little bit later on, or perhaps holding out specific years in your data to try to gain a little bit more confidence, as you said, that your models are going to extrapolate.
Or I could imagine a world where we don't have to hold back, 2017 or 2016. Let's hold out 2009. Right. Let's fit a model from 2005 to 2016. Hold out 2009, and then test the model in 2009. How did it do on that one? I bet you the answer is not that well, probably, in the typical actuarial model. What do you think?
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I typically, once again, in the projects I've been involved with, I try to speak to the ones I've personally been involved with.
Sure.
We do take a look at those cuts and make sure the model's performing consistently.
So you run those tests?
Yes, we do.
Okay. That's more sophisticated than I've seen.
I can't speak to what's happening around our industry. Most of the professionals I interact with are exhibiting the best practices you discuss.
Yep.
What I think for me is very challenging for analytics professionals, which was alluded to in your prior podcast, is once that thing gets out in the real world, even these so-called holdout data sets are synthetic to a certain degree. Once you get them out in the real world, it's really difficult to isolate how they're performing, especially since there's a lot of conflating exogenous factors in play. So you may put in a new pricing segmentation model, and your loss ratio could deteriorate by 2%. But how do you know it wouldn't have deteriorated by 4% if you didn't have the pricing model in place?
Right. The thing that the way I like to characterize actuarial data sets, at least up to more recently, and one of the most fascinating, I think, subsets of the actuarial profession, working with bigger data sets, is actually we do small data sets, right? Small, high. There's an academic whose name escapes me right now, but called it very causally dense. So there's a lot going on. There are way more parameters than there are data points. And so the best answer I can think of anyway for, and I do this all the time myself, right? So I'm in the reinsurance business where it's usually like you got 5 years of data in a single data point for each year. You can build a triangle to kind of expand that a little bit. But I mean, there's so much going on that you spend all your time not necessarily applying the mathematics of the actuarial profession, but applying the intuition and just trying to tell a story that makes sense for what's going on. And in that sense, from a narrative perspective, holdout data sets don't make any sense. It would make sense to exclude 2010 because you're missing a key part of the middle of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And so in this narrative construction, I guess, application of our professional tools, it's just not math. I guess it's modeling, but it's not technical modeling. It's more of a storytelling modeling, I guess. What do you think about that?
You allude to the fact that we're working oftentimes with rather small data sets, and it's debatable whether as an industry and a profession we ever even got really good at the small data sets.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I agree.
One of the things I like to talk about, just because, if you're at a cocktail party and you don't know anybody, it's kind of a nice icebreaker, is the 2016 election, because the pollsters got the predictions so dreadfully wrong.
Yes.
And I think that definitely sent a chill down my spine as someone whose job it is to make predictions for a living, because it's like, oh my gosh, am I making predictions that are that drastically wrong? And you can look at all the best practices or maybe not so best practices we're exhibiting individually and as a profession. But if you just look at the results, myself and a colleague did a study of some rate level reviews that have been conducted in our industry over the past several years, just to see how many of them reverse themselves within 1 or 2 years. Not even change sign, substantially reverse themselves.
Okay.
So you have a +5% rate indication. You notify your agents, you put it in your systems, you send out the policyholder notices, you tell the regulators, you do everything you have to do, you spend all that money, time, and effort. And then 1 or 2 years later, boom, -5, completely reversed.
Yeah.
We were kind of curious how often that happens, because although you can't say this with certainty, I mean, that's some indication that maybe our prediction was a little bit wrong. And luckily, in the study we did, the majority of the time, the rate level indications didn't completely reverse themselves within 1 or 2 years, but it did happen a little bit more often than perhaps I would think.
Why do you think that would have happened?
Because Yogi Berra has an expression, which is making predictions is hard, especially about the future.
Yeah.
There are just so many things you don't know at the time you make the analysis. And even as much data as you can bring into the equation to supplement the smaller data sets maybe historically we've had at our disposal, there's still so much we don't know about the future. And there, in many cases, are going to be so many assumptions involved that model risk is very difficult to bring down to zero.
Well, so what do you think, one interpretation of all this, which is, I think, what you're saying, and this was always ringing in my mind during my conversation with Kathy, is that it's just really hard, like just plain hard to do. It's hard, you know, the Yogi Berra quote is right on the money. It's just hard to make predictions. It's hard to forecast. And so people underestimate how hard it is. Can you think of sort of an easy common pitfall for somebody who wanders in and says, I'm going to build a model? What's like a first thing that they would get wrong that, or, you know, the first thing you learn about pit modeling? And can you remember like an early lesson you might've had?
Gosh, I mean, for me, a sort of a eureka moment was that the metrics can trick you.
Mm.
So one metric that oftentimes is
evaluation of how good you're doing, you mean?
Absolutely. Yes. Right. That's a very good characterization. If you're looking at a generalized linear model, which is more or less the state of the art, in my opinion, when it comes to pricing, we've seen some more sophisticated approaches used. You hear references to machine learning, but at least in the folks I interact with, I would say a good plurality of them are still using generalized linear models. And they spit out the algorithms you're running in programming languages like SAS or R or Python, what's called error statistics, and something referred to as a p-value. And I'm not sure anybody, I'm not sure I knew, you know, what the heck these things even meant when I first started analyzing
them. And
they're
tricky little definitions for that stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm still not sure I know what they mean. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, you're told you're looking for something like a p-value less than 1% or less than 0.1% or 0.01%. And the lower, the better. And you'll get these generalized linear modeling outputs that just look absolutely phenomenal. And you can congratulate yourself on the fact that you've built a very robust model. And of course, we should be doing, and in as an industry, I think by and large, we are doing this, the tests, like you mentioned, looking at all sorts of different cuts of holdout data. But in general, if you're not doing those sorts of checks, you can very easily trick yourself into thinking you have a great model because of the p-values, because they're actually gameable. I mean, there are inputs to the generalized linear modeling procedures in SAS, for instance, that can substantially affect the error statistics and make your uncertainty look like much less than it is. Mm. So for me, it's trust but verify. You can never really be sure, as we said, how these things are actually going to work in the real world. And you may never know just because there's so many conflating exogenous factors in practice. But at a minimum, you should be doing that additional digging before you bring something out into the world.
Well, and there's an inherent volatility to the data itself, even given a pretty good model, because your data sets are only so big. And I'm thinking back to your point about the 2016 election, and I think you're referring to the, I think it was the 522 blog, Nate Silver, where he made a prediction and didn't turn out right. I think he did pretty well the time before that. And I remember listening in advance of that election, a podcast interview with Nate, I think it was, or maybe it was just a written interview, where he said, here's the thing. We have a 10% error margin, 19 out of 20 times or whatever. I'm not even sure what the 19 out of 20 means anymore. I think that has to do with the type 2 error. But he said, you know, the margin of victory for an election is like 2 or 3%, right? And I have a 10% error margin. Like, I don't know why you people are even talking to me because I can't tell you an answer. I could make a point estimate prediction, but it's just the volatility. This is another point I made in my conversation with Kathy, where she was asking about hurricane risk. And she said, well, is there not this clear trend about increasing hurricanes? And I said, well, the price reaction this year was not that strong. And the challenge is that the difference in people's estimates for kind of how bad, much worse next year is going to be is overshadowed by the volatility of the underlying data set. And so the margin of error is bigger than the gap between the pessimists and the optimists. And there's just not a whole lot you can do, I think, with that.
One of the things I struggle with was the 2016 election failure in prediction due to the fact that the outcome was just a hurricane, a 1-in-100-year event?
Yep.
Or was it basically a routine occurrence that the pundits and predictors completely missed? And I'm not sure anyone really knows the answer to that question, although it's been studied to some extent. I view Nate Silver as someone who, when it comes to the election, did a fairly good job in 2016, because if you look at all the assessments of Donald Trump's chances of victory, Nate Silver had it on the relatively high side. On the eve of the election, I think it was somewhere between a quarter and a third. Mm. Whereas the Princeton Election Consortium, if I recall correctly, had the prediction the possibility of his winning around 1%.
Right. And 1 in 3 is not, it's not that bad.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things I'd like to turn to is the different modeling tools. Now, you mentioned GLMs, and one of the things that interests me about the actuarial profession is GLMs dominate the landscape. And yet, if you look at the greater data science community, well, actually, let me qualify that. If you look at the online data science community, right? So, if you know Kaggle, you ever heard of Kaggle? So, yes. Kaggle being this machine learning competition website, it's a really cool community. You can learn. I mean, it's more or less how I learned how to program was just reading the Kaggle blog, and they don't use GLMs. I don't think. I remember looking into it in Python, and I think it was in Python, yeah, in the scikit-learn library, and it didn't even have a GLM module. And so there's all this other stuff. There's random forests. There's all kinds of gradient boosting. And I think those are the same thing even maybe. And there's like a thousand different models, but they didn't even have a GLM in there. So what – it's probably a little bit too simplistic to ask who's right. But why the gap between actuaries and the kind of mainstream data science community, do you think?
Well, I don't even know if there is a right. I mean, is the answer to get to the perfect price point? Can that perfect price point be achieved through using machine learning instead of GLM? I'm not sure the perfect price point can ever be achieved.
Sure.
You know, in the prior podcast, Kathy alluded to something which I thought was quite cogent, which was, you know, big data and insurance aren't necessarily fast friends, because if you ever get to the perfect price point, you're essentially shrinking your market because you're keeping people out of the system at a price point they can't bear. Just because their risk is so high, the insurance would be unaffordable for them. So from my perspective, as to why GLMs have sort of dominated, I think part of it may just be that as an industry, insurance tends to be a little bit slower to evolve to new technology and technique. But there's also intuitive appeal to GLMs in terms of their explainability, which can sometimes be a double-edged sword. You know, I was involved in the filing of a GLM-based rating rule with a regulator in the southern half of the United States. And they asked us to qualitatively rationalize a cause and effect relationship between every one of
them. Tell me a story about why this works.
Yes.
Right.
And we actually, some of our stories may have been more intuitive than others. I mean, it's not necessarily required under standards of practice that you have a cause and effect relationship between every variable in your risk classification system and the thing it's trying to predict. But in general, we were able to participate in that exercise. If we were using an approach that brought more variables and more nested relationships between the variables into the prediction process, the ability to have that conversation would have deteriorated. Mm. Now, is this a conversation we need to be having? Certainly wasn't a conversation I enjoyed having. I think to some degree, applying that smell test to the types of variables you're looking at and is there some basis in reality can be a healthy thing, but I don't think it should be preclusive of our exploring more complex approaches where prudent. But I'm not sure pricing is necessarily the prudent place for it. It may be, but there are a lot of use cases for big data, for analytics, for sophisticated techniques in our industry, which far transcend pricing.
So one thing you mentioned there, which really interested me, that I'm wondering if you could elaborate on a little bit. You said we don't necessarily need to have a direct causal relationship between every single variable and the outcome. What do you mean by that exactly? What I thought you were going for, and sorry to interrupt you were about to talk again there, was that collectively you have a collective evaluation of the model efficacy, and then you have an individual evaluation of the component efficacy, and if all the individual components add up to a model that works, then the model works, right? And so there might be some kind of problem with an individual component, but you do have to consider it holistically as well. Am I right on that? Is that the right way to think about it, you think?
I'm just thinking in terms of the standards. I was kind of at a loss for words when you posed that question because I'm not sure it's something I've really thought through in a nuanced way, so I appreciate your posing it and giving me the opportunity to think about it in a nuanced way today. But I guess as I'm sort of thinking about it on the fly, if ultimately, as presently constituted, we're trying to align price with risk, then it would seem that we shouldn't place artificial constraints on our ability to do that. Now, we've heard discussion in our industry, quite a bit of discussion and very heated discussion about price optimization. And that's not doing risk-based pricing, but rather considering factors such as people's willingness and ability to pay.
Yeah.
My own personal opinion on that is that that's not necessarily problematic in every scenario. It may be problematic in some scenarios, but I look across the pond in Africa where we're seeing microinsurance programs. And when you're designing a microinsurance program to serve an underserved population with very little ability to pay, the primary factor in your design of the program and arrival at a price point is going to be willingness and ability to pay. Because if you don't drive a price point that meets those criteria, then no one's going to buy the product. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe those rules don't apply in a mature market. But right now, as I observe sort of what's happening in the marketplace, we're in what's arguably a non-tenable middle ground. Because price optimization is verboten. And whether or not that's prudent is beyond the
debatable
limits of my intellect.
Yeah, sure.
But at the same time, if we reach perfect risk-based pricing, we're necessarily going to be excluding people from the system just because their risk is so high that they couldn't be sustainably insurable. Mm. So as we sort of waffle between those two extrema, it's difficult to provide a nuanced answer to your question, I think.
So one other issue that I mull over periodically is when you have more sophisticated stratification of loss costs. So you have a group of people and you have the distribution of loss costs amongst that group. You're going to have this average where you're saying, let's say the average cost is $800 a car or per person, I guess. And then, but the range goes from a loss cost of like $50 per person to like 5,000 or something crazy like that, right? And he said, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could separate all these people out into more refined buckets and charge them rates according to their loss cost? And I'm intrigued by the limitations of that framework because on the one hand, you don't really change anything about the marketplace. You're not making any more or less money by doing that. You change the mix of your book potentially, but why bother, I suppose, is the question. Why would anybody care to stratify versus not stratify?
As you're further stratifying, and everyone in our industry is in order to either achieve a competitive advantage or at least prevent themselves from having a competitive advantage wielded against them, one could argue that we've sort of set ourselves in a death spiral.
Yeah.
Because we're introducing more and more cost and more effort and more data at arriving at ever more accurate price points. Ultimately, introducing the costs of the data and the analysis is going to increase the price point just by virtue of the fact that that's a general expense, which is ultimately going to get loaded into the rates. And ultimately, this is going to potentially, make insurance more challenging to purchase, not only for that cohort, perhaps it falls in the extremely high-risk categories, but also for everyone, just in the fact that we're embarking ever more effort in arriving at these perfect price points. That's why I would offer that perhaps it's more prudent to look into alternative uses besides pricing. There's always going to be room for big data and analytics and pricing. We can always get a price point that perhaps is more appropriate just by virtue of the fact that models grow older and we need to keep them current over time. But I feel there's particularly significant opportunities in looking at using new technologies, new data for distribution, for claims, particularly parametric settlement and so forth. And that's why I think some of the most significant innovations we're seeing in our industry in property and casualty right now are in the microinsurance arena.
Microinsurance in the U.S.? Probably not, I guess.
Debatable whether or not microinsurance is actually being offered in the U.S. I'm not aware of any being explicitly termed as such, although that doesn't necessarily mean it isn't, just means I'm not aware of it.
Yeah.
But I would offer that some of the insurtech activity we see has microinsurance-like properties in terms of a small premium, perhaps a shorter coverage period.
So define microinsurance. Maybe it's useful so we can make sure I understand what you mean.
I mean, if you pop microinsurance into Google, you'll probably get a bunch of different definitions. My own personal definition would be affordable insurance for underserved segments of the insurable population.
Interesting. Okay. And an example of microinsurance, where the hotbed of microinsurance would be in Africa, I guess, right? Or in developing countries in Asia?
We tend to see it most predominantly in developing nations. Yes.
Right. Okay. And so what are some examples of it? Is there like a poster child? The most successful microinsurance product has been this that is useful to think about?
I think we've yet to see the biggest success stories, but one of the greatest privileges of my career was to volunteer on the CAS working party for microinsurance.
And okay.
Although I've never personally done anything of significance in microinsurance, I had the opportunity to work with professionals who were involved with Blue Marble Microinsurance Venture Incubator, AB consultants in Kenya, actually designing these from remotely or even administering them on the ground. And some of the most impressive efforts I've seen are, for instance, using smartphones for distribution. You'd see very high mobile penetration in developing nations. Oftentimes you see mobile money. So this is a very logical distribution channel for these markets. You see very streamlined coverages, low limits, basically just meeting the basic need. And that's a virtual must to keep the coverage affordable. But where you really see sophistication is when you have such a promising but brand new population, you don't want to undermine faith in the product. And you also want to keep the price point manageable. So you can't have this extensive, expensive claims management process. So that's one of the reasons why you see parametric being very common in microinsurance. And a success story I would point to is the use of point sensors. There's a program that was launched in Zimbabwe recently. It's a drought product. It's using on-the-ground sensors to measure rainfall. It's using satellite imagery. And the payout is essentially right away if it's deemed drought occurred. So
this is a crop insurance or something else?
Correct. It's agricultural inputs.
Okay.
So if your crop dies, you get new seed.
Okay.
Essentially.
But the risk is the covered value, I suppose, is crop. I mean, that's why they're buying it,
yes,
to insure their crops.
Yes.
And so crop, what are some other products that people buy in those markets?
I mean, in those markets, you're generally not going to see automobiles,
right,
fine art,
or
guns necessarily insured.
Yeah.
So it's going to be the basic thing. Life is the area where we've seen the greatest penetration of microinsurance. But you see crop, you see basic structures, disability.
And over here, I think of the this is something that came up in my conversation with Don Mango, both of them, which he's really passionate about. And I actually emailed him in advance of this conversation and asked him what he thought I might want to ask about. And Internet of Things, micro devices, sensor devices, the promise that those might hold for data sets that can help in the pricing of insurance and other parts of insurance. I mean, have you spent time working on that?
Earlier in my career, I was involved in building rating plans that involve telematics, which I would put under the realm of Internet of Things. I've done a little bit of exploration with wearable devices. I would say those are my two primary forays into the Internet of Things.
Do they work, you think?
From my own
perspective. What ways do they and do they not work? Maybe that's a better way of putting it. Well, just give us the whole analysis.
I guess before I would give my own opinion, what do you think? Does Internet of Things work?
I haven't worked on it myself directly. So here's my view is that I'm intrigued because lots of data, right? I wonder what I've read is that there's a cost involved in actually building the infrastructure, and that cost raises the bar, right? So now it's not just, hey, can I make more money on this by identifying, I suppose, parts of my book which are running better than they're not, but now it's like, can I cover the cost and identify those which are more than making up the difference? And I think that the results get ambiguous at that point. But again, not having really done a study myself directly, I don't know, not super confident in that conclusion, I guess.
I definitely agree with your assessment. I do think there's a little bit of a square peg, round hole type problem where you have this very sophisticated data, but you're trying to jam it into sort of 20th century pricing constructs, which may or may not make sense. But I'm very bullish on the technology in general, because I think it's something that can unify all the different cohorts of the overall insurance population. And, you know, we talked about microinsurance, but another topic which you've seen covered in trade media recently is macroinsurance, where conceivably all of your risks could be covered on a single policy.
Yeah.
And I think IoT is sort of the technological bridge that pulls those two things together. Because, as I mentioned, mobile penetration is very high in developing segments. It's also very high in developed segments. And when you look at perhaps the overinsured population, your smartphone, for instance, is going to be a very good tool to link up everything in your house and make sure that's insured. So I think as we're leveraging these technologies, it gives our industry a lot of flexibility for growth.
I wonder, too, about this transition that actuaries might be going to. This is another old Mango hot point, which is companies are hiring data scientists. They should just be using actuaries. Yet we talked earlier about how actuaries are used to dealing with pretty small data sets for the most part and constructing or understanding narratives that lie within the data set, so using the insurance intuition to apply to that. Do you think it's a role for actuaries to consume these data sets and work with them?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we have a data science program at our organization where we rotate data scientists through various organizations, including my own. And I work in a more actuarial area, but we have a data scientist on our team right now. In the process of interviewing these positions, there was one that struck me about 6 months ago, because the candidate said, well, gosh, you know, I used to be an actuary, or at least I was pursuing an actuarial credential, but I decided to become a data scientist because I really want to make an impact. And that kind of struck me, because it's like, wait a second, actuaries can make a really substantial impact because we're basically responsible for all these financial promises insurance companies are making. From my own perspective, if I were to sort of grotesquely characterize actuaries versus data scientists, I would perhaps classify them as pragmatists versus idealists, which would you think would align with each of those descriptions if we were to match actuary and data scientist with pragmatist versus idealist?
I mean, I would definitely say actuaries are the pragmatists. I mean, actually, let me think about this. I think good actuaries and good data scientists are indistinguishable, to be honest with you, because when I read about it, about data science, and I have read a fair bit of it, I'm really interested in the field, and I don't see that there's really any difference between an actuary and a data scientist with deep insurance domain knowledge. And so the best data scientists, as they say, are those that actually wind up learning a lot about the business that they're modeling, enough so that they can develop their own intuitions about the data. I mean, the world of pure black box modeling, I think, is far away, if not infinitely far away, and maybe of no use to us even when we see it, because we're not going to understand what's going on anyway. So it's just kind of useless to sort of try to reason about it.
For sure.
How am I doing?
No, I would tend to take the opposite tack. I mean, perhaps it's because I consider myself an idealist and I consider myself an actuary.
Okay.
But I tend to find the actuaries more idealistic, because being more embedded in the business by nature of their training, although they're wielding similar techniques to data scientists, they're more in touch with the problems of the business. And most people of an optimistic nature believe any problem is solvable with enough elbow grease.
Yeah.
In that way, I perceive idealism in actuaries. Whereas as I interact with data scientists who are certainly more skilled in technique than I am, generally I would characterize some of our interactions as, here are the constraints imposed upon us by the data. What can we then do in the context of problem solving?
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I would sort of characterize them in the pragmatist category.
That's interesting. I think that maybe we're coming at a similar idea from different directions. So my definition of idealist would be somebody who doesn't understand and doesn't really want to understand the messiness of a problem. And the pragmatist is somebody who just is ignoring everything you're saying until we're talking dirty details about the problem. And in my experience in the actuarial profession, you get a loss triangle, for example, and you kind of have a look at it and you're like, this is so little information for me to make a decision about what's going on here that I need so much more nuance. It's not even really worth talking about at this point. What do you think about that?
I agree. In when you look at it in that sense, the line between the two tends to blur, because I think everybody, or at least the vast majority of us, want to understand the problem and make an impact on it by understanding it in a nuanced way and therefore designing a very relevant solution.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps because we're a little bit less mired in technique, the actuarial community would be a little bit more petrified of rolling up our sleeves and getting deep into some of these complex problems. So in that way, yeah, I definitely agree with your take on it.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is that we're trying to make our techniques more complicated. We do all the time. I mean, you go through the syllabus is kind of one way of learning about the actuarial techniques, and that's kind of the canon, right? But if you were to ever poke around through the CAS website and look at all the papers on rate making and stuff, I mean, there is some complex stuff there. It doesn't make it to the syllabus because I think that it's not really adding a lot of value necessarily. I mean, I'm making a generalization there, but let's just assume I'm right with that. Not making a lot of value. So the story I want to tell here is that we try and make it more complex, but more complicated tools are actually not really a good fit for a really complicated problem because they're just obscuring the simplicity of the story, telling a story about the problem. Like we as humans don't have the ability to consume very complicated causal mechanisms about complicated problems. You know, you can have like a complicated problem and a simple model, or a complicated model and a simple problem. And maybe both of either of those two things are things that we're happy about, because we can either reason about the problem, and then so you can use that to check if the problem is simple. A complicated model is okay because we have an intuition for what the answer should be. But if you have a really complicated problem, you kind of need a simple model in order to extract what information, the simple story out of the complicated problem. Do you know what I mean? And so if you try to make the tools too complicated, you just don't understand anything, because you don't understand the problem. You don't understand the solution. You get a number at the end, but you can't tell anybody about why, whether it's right or not, or run any tests.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute point. The mix of complicated problem and complicated solution is a particularly problematic one from my perspective, because you can be applying some algorithmic approach that you have a nominal understanding of and getting something that appears to be responsive to the problem you perceive. But if you don't really understand why exactly the approach you're taking does solve that problem, then how do you know it's not just a coincidence?
You know, it's interesting about that. It just occurred to me as you were talking there, is wondering what the objective is of modeling. So one characterization of the objective of modeling is to get an answer that you can use, right? So I get a rate or I get a loss estimate or something like that. But I wonder whether the real objective is to get to develop an understanding for the problem, which is a human consumable, right? So it's not to the point you're making before about having to pitch to some regulators. They're saying, tell me a story about why this works. And you're like, okay, well, this is going to take a little while because there's a lot going on here. And they're probably saying in their minds, well, good. Well, unless you can give me understanding of the solution or the problem, then you're not doing your job. And so the output isn't the answer. The output is the story, which allows humans to communicate about what's going on and then decide on the answer actually themselves, because the regulator is an important stakeholder and whatever the answer is going to be ultimately, right?
And the story is almost certainly wrong.
Yeah, sure.
Whenever we're hypothesizing some synthetic explanation for something a model identifies. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Even just the nature of having these conversations makes us all a little bit smarter. I mean, I think my career path in P&C is by no means unique in terms of evolving from using relatively rudimentary pricing approaches, just kind of riding the tide and getting into some more sophisticated modeling type approaches. And perhaps it's the evolution of the business, but I think for me, it's been the evolution of the projects. As I get involved in these more modeling projects, there tends to be a lot more conversations just by virtue of the fact that you're building something new.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just basically keeping a machine in operation, the level of discourse as to what that machine's actually doing tends to deteriorate over time. And as people move on from their roles and you get new people who have perhaps never even looked inside the machine, that understanding of what the machine's actually doing tends to deteriorate. In terms of the aspirations of a model, aside from, of course, gaining the optimal performance according to n odd statistical metrics you may be inclined to look at, it's ultimately to solve a problem. And in that way, you're building something new. And because you're building something new, there's sort of an inherent recognition that there's a problem you don't fully understand. And in that way, if you have the humility to recognize that you don't have all the answers, you're naturally going to be engaging a wide group of stakeholders to clarify, define the problem, and then ultimately design the solution.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are some interesting lines of business that have been substantially improved as a result of kind of deep modeling, let's call it, or sophisticated modeling, GLMs, over the last, call it, you know, the course of your career? So that'd be what, kind of 20 years or so, is that right? Which one's the best one that's made progress on?
I'm not sure there's a single line of business I point to as the defining success story, because I think everybody has different criteria for success. But as long as I've been in the industry for about 15 years now, the use of algorithmic techniques for pricing, maybe more sophisticated than were used in the types of stuff you may have seen on the syllabus until as recently as 5 years ago, they've been in place for personal lines for quite a long time. But over the course of my career, I've seen substantial growth in commercial lines, literally because my organization does a survey of folks in the industry and says, are you using analytics for this line of business, and that line of business? And we see substantial growth in some commercial lines, particularly what I'll call the more commoditized commercial lines, like commercial auto or business owners. And commercial auto is a line of business that really interests me just because it's kind of been the best of times and the worst of times over the years. And especially in recent years, it's definitely been the worst of times.
Yeah.
And as the problem becomes more well understood and more feared, you've seen more and more analytics thrown at the problem. Whether or not they actually solve the problem, I think, is a story that's yet to be written. We're going to find that out. But for me, I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing in the space, that at least there's recognition of a problem. And instead of what I alluded to earlier being, gosh, we've got a lot of data, where's a problem we can go solve? It's the opposite. It's, here's a big problem. It's burning a hole in our profitability. How do we understand this risk better and adjust pricing, ideally in a way that incentivizes better risk behaviors, but at a minimum, insulating us from something that's basically just going to reduce our ability to deliver on our promises in terms of eroding that surplus via terrible profitability in this line.
So what would be, let me ask this differently. The pessimistic view is that it can't be done, right? So actually, I think Connors and Feldblum, to the paper I referenced earlier, is in some ways a pretty pessimistic evaluation of how good data science can be, because they say it's actually all about the legal environment. Sorry. You know, you think that it's accident frequency, and they make a point in the paper that claims frequency over the course of some period, I think it was late 80s, went up by 10%, something like that, but accident frequency went down by 15%. And so there was actually a net increase of 30-some-odd% in the the litigation rate. So you had an accident in 1985, you wouldn't have hired a lawyer and filed a claim. You had the same accident in 1991, you were 30% more likely to do that. And so that's just the entire problem is simply legal environment, which is more or less kind of the state of the understanding of the business generally, right? So push back against that for me. Please don't make this a pessimistic conversation. Surely we can do better than that.
Well, from my perspective, whether or not you subscribe to the hypothesis that all the exogenous factors are ultimately just going to be the only thing that decides the future, and in that way it's inherently unpredictable, I would offer that the answer to that question in part hinges on whether or not you believe those factors are macroscopic versus microscopic. Mm. And I think the answer lies somewhere in between. But if I were to sort of place myself somewhere on that pendulum, I would offer it tends to be more macroscopic.
So what do you mean by macroscopic or microscopic? So let's dig into those a bit.
Does legal environment tend to evolve in a particular jurisdiction, or does it tend to evolve for the nation as a whole or for a particular region?
Mm-hmm.
My sense is, yes, you'll see a jurisdiction change rapidly from time to time, but at least, and I don't have any evidence on the tip of my tongue to support this, so it's pure hypothesis on my part, but I would offer that it tends to be more macroscopic, and you see regional and national shifts over time. And in that way, I feel like the traditional tools are very well equipped to pick up these effects, taking rate level changes every year, year after year.
Mm-hmm.
If commercial auto had been taking sufficient rate level changes, perhaps it wouldn't be in the predicament it's in right now. And there's been recovery in that sense. But if you subscribe to the hypothesis, which I personally do, that the macroscopic factors can be understood in a rudimentary sense and addressed through traditional techniques, then the question becomes,
what's left?
Yes.
Yeah. The problem we can solve next is what's going on that, you know, and I like that actually, because you don't necessarily need to throw out the original techniques. You're still using them. You're just layering on more.
And the more can be important. You know, a recent project I worked on, which I think is indicative of some of the evolution we've seen for commercial auto, is there's a construct in P&C, which many people are probably familiar with, which is called symbols. And mm-hmm.
What is a symbol? I'm not sure. That's just the make of the car. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I have no idea where the term symbol came from.
It's a funny one, because I think of it in my mind. I think of it anyway. So for the sake of the audience, symbol is the classification of a car. And so when you have a list of cars, when you're writing an auto insurance portfolio, then you have the symbol and year. Is that the two kind of main variables?
Those are the key ones.
Define what the car is. And you have this huge list of these databases that have the value of the car over time and depreciation factors by symbol. And that is like, do you have a Porsche or do you have a Toyota? Kind of thing, right?
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Right. So a symbol on the hood.
Yeah, and a Toyota Camry versus a Toyota Highlander. And,
right, okay.
And so forth.
Yeah, the make and model.
Yeah. And this is something that's been utilized in personal auto for 50 years. The approaches have gotten more sophisticated over time, but essentially in nature, it hasn't really changed. It's exactly what you said it just is.
Yeah.
And yet, why did no one ever think to do that for commercial auto until we saw a massive profitability deterioration in recent years? Symbols are something that have been regarded by some as having a positive societal effect because it encourages people to purchase safer vehicles. It encourages manufacturers to engineer safer vehicles because to the extent the insurance is a part of the overall cost of vehicle ownership, of course, you're going to want that safe vehicle in your hand. So begs the question why this has never happened for commercial auto. But, you know, if you're looking for silver linings in something that otherwise has been a very grim occurrence for our industry, which is the commercial auto profitability debacle, I think the fact that you're seeing things like symbols showing up for commercial auto finally is a very good thing.
Mm. And what do you think about the use of proxies versus causal variables or identifying one or the other? Another thing that came up in Connors and Feldblum, and it's just, I mean, this just comes up everywhere. It came up in my conversation with Kathy O'Neill, which we've mentioned a few times here, which is using proxy variables is not necessarily predictive of loss activity, but it's associated with loss activity. And there's an underlying cause that would affect both the proxy and the actual loss activity. What do you think about that?
I feel it's very difficult to identify something that can be used to predict risk behavior that isn't a proxy unless you're essentially just doing individual risk rating. Mm. Because ultimately, unless you're using something like prior claims to predict future claims, what variable isn't proxying for something? I mean, a variable that's regarded as highly predictive and well understood, and I think everybody agrees with, is, you know, charging teenage drivers a little bit more because
they are worse drivers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in and of itself about being a high school senior dude that makes you any more or less likely to crash your car than, for instance, a high school, you know, senior dudette. or a dude who's 25 years old.
Yeah.
So I struggle personally to find variables that can explicitly be pointed to as cause and effect and not proxies.
And some will be closer than others, I suppose, because at least when I was telling a story to a friend of mine recently, actually. So within a week and a half of getting my driver's license, I'm from Canada, I got in two accidents. And so I don't think I've been in an accident since. If I have, it might have been soon after that. But that's not a great track record. Out of the gates, 10 days in, two accidents. My parents had two cars. I managed to put both of them in the shop. And my story for why was that I was just a bad driver. I was inexperienced, is a better way of putting it, which means bad driver. And since then, I've encountered similar situations to those that caused the accidents or led to the accidents, and I have been able to avoid having accidents since because I understood some ways to learn the hard way. So I can see some relationship, or at least call it a similar or a very close causal mechanism to age. That one I think is probably pretty easy, but you get into things like marital status or other things. I mean, I'm not sure what else. And they become more distant proxies. I suppose what I'm getting at here, what I'm curious about your thoughts on, are does the question of identifying proxies or non-proxies, or call it the distance of the proxiness of the variable from some causal factor, do you think about that when you model things, or is that, I mean, where does that enter in the analysis?
I would offer it enters the analysis right at the design phase, because to the point you're designing a predictive model to solve a particular problem, you're bringing in data that you believe to be relevant to the problem. I mean, I guess in an economically unconstrained situation, perhaps you'd be bringing in every single data source under the sun and throwing it into your model and seeing what sticks. But at least in my experiences, that's just not practical or economically feasible, even if anyone would want to do that. So even, for instance, when you're designing a territory model, you're going to be bringing in data sets that you think are relevant to understanding the problem, like the local population. For instance, are there a lot of youthful drivers in the area? Elevation, you know, is there a big slope in the area? Weather. So to this extent, I would offer it's at the design phase. Now, within these data sets, what actually shows up as being predictive, perhaps that's a little bit more algorithmic. I guess when you're in a generalized linear modeling setting, it's easier to say, well, gosh, I have two variables that have similar predictive power. Why don't I just take the one that seems a little bit more intuitive? As you get into the approaches that are more layered and nested, like random forests, it becomes a little bit more difficult to do that. But I think by and large, at least in my perception, our industry has done a solid job of reaching for data sets that aren't too far removed from the problem on an intuitive level.
One of the things that I've observed about some rating models, personal lines, I think, tend to be a bit more egregious maybe in this respect, is they tend to have a lot in them, right? There are a lot of features, and there's this feeling that it's kind of a race to the bottom, top, where you kind of feel like you have to put everything in there because other people are doing it too, and you're just worried about missing out as opposed to any kind of objective measurement of its quality. And I sympathize with that, because in the end, it doesn't really matter so much. There's at some point, there's a trade-off between the accuracy of your model and whether you are just forgetting or sort of missing something in the marketplace. And so, you know, if you're sacrificing a little bit of your stated accuracy, and you know the model has some kind of margin of error, but now you're more aligned with the other carriers and you're competing more on a level playing ground or a consistent playground with them, you kind of go for that, right? And so the modeler's objective isn't necessarily, or the modeler's voice isn't necessarily the one that is that's the loudest. Do you encounter that problem of thinking about kind of this collective action with the industry is guiding people's actions as opposed to what the right answer is from a modeling perspective?
You could certainly make the case that's happening. I mean, you know, we talked about the 2016 election a little bit earlier, and one of the things you noticed that was that most of the pundits were wrong in approximately the same way by approximately the same amount, because they were all using very similar techniques.
Yeah.
And in that way, I think in insurance, whether it's modeling or it's even more traditional rate making reserving type techniques, you do see a lot of groupthink. And in that way, there's a risk to doing things differently than everybody else. But I think when you look at the insurance tech community, you are seeing some forays into trying things a little bit differently. You know, one that's been in trade media a little bit more recently is the idea of social proof, right? You know, instead of looking at this, that, and the other thing to figure out whether or not I'm a risky policyholder, why don't I just have a few of my friends vouch that I'm a relatively lower risk policyholder? Mm-hmm. But then if it turns out I crash my car, they're going to experience some sort of debit as a result of referring me. Now, whether or not that particular use case that we've seen reported publicly in trade media succeeds, I don't know. But that's coming at the problem from a different angle. And ultimately, the more our industry becomes mired in groupthink, I think more of these plays are a little bit different. And instead of using 500 different data sources to try to arrive at the perfect price point, they're using one that really makes a lot of sense, does a good job, and everybody understands and likes. They could be the big winners here.
Mm-hmm. Where do regulators come in on these sort of innovative business models? I ask this question honestly. How are they presented with something that's new, if you're aware of this? So you have a new technique. When does the regulator say yes or no? Right away or later on? Or do you have to give it to them before you file it? When you're filing a rating plan, maybe? How do they?
There are a lot of discussions happening in the regulatory community, which I'm not an active participant in. And yep. So I won't offer knowledge I don't have, but I've found my experiences with regulators on predictive models has been phenomenal because they ask really, really good questions. Hmm. And oftentimes, even when you thought you've asked yourselves all the questions in your design process that there are to ask, they'll pick up on something that maybe you just didn't think of. And 99 times out of 100, I've hypothesized, you know, if you've done the due diligence on your end and a regulator thinks of something you didn't think of, you're going to have a good answer for that as well, just because your product was designed in a reasonable and appropriate way. But in general, these algorithms are so complex that oftentimes it's very difficult to understand what they're doing. And it takes a village to understand. Now, one would hope you have that village internally. And by and large, in my experiences, most of the individuals I work with, most of the organizations I work with, those communities are in place to make sure these models are doing what they're supposed to and operating responsibly. But having another voice at the table, another party asking good questions, another party making sure the I's are dotted and the T's crossed, I find it's a very healthy experience. And I enjoy the interactions with regulators quite a bit.
So maybe it's worth actually touching, maybe we should have done this earlier, on what exactly it is that you do. In what ways do you interact with regulators? Who are your clients? What are sort of projects that you're working on right now? You work at ISO. I think we've mentioned that. Yes, we did at the beginning.
Right now, I work on a solution of tools. It's primary territory models for several lines of business. They use external data sources such as census or business points or weather or elevation or traffic to try to arrive at a more accurate price point for a particular geography. And that can be at a census block group level, a zip code level, traditionally a more geographically refined level than an insurer might be looking at via their present practices. So we work with many insurers in the industry. And my interactions with regulators has largely been in filing rating approaches based on these territory models and educating them in the inner workings of the model, gaining mutual comfort, and ultimately getting them approved, acknowledged, implemented, such that carriers can use these to more accurately and precisely price their policies.
Maybe it's worth tying in the history of ISO a little bit here. So ISO, I mean, you probably know more than I do. Tell us a bit about kind of ISO's origins and kind of, I think of its main, just to calibrate the conversation a little bit here, I think of its main product as actually being the survey of loss costs in various lines of business, right? That came about over the course of a long period of history. Can you talk a little bit about development?
Well, ISO is older than I am.
Yeah,
I was born in 1981, and ISO was born arguably long before I was. So I'm not sure I'm the best person to provide a corporate history of ISO. But the general notion you describe, I would offer as one accurate characterization of ISO, which is that we collect information from a number of insurance companies. That definitely allows the law of large numbers to come into play and allows us to form more accurate predictions. And then using this data and using the analyses we do, we are able to furnish companies who are our customers and our partners with advisory insights, which they may elect to utilize to improve their decision making, improve their pricing, and so forth.
Now, what's interesting to me is that the standard ISO product, being this loss cost survey and a few other related analytical insights, are not what you're working on. I mean, you probably include that information in your work, but you're bringing in outside external data sets. And so am I thinking about that right? That your contribution to the ISO product suite is, hey, there's lots of other data out there that we can add to these models, and let me work on that with you too. Is that right?
That's accurate. I mean, there's no one single thing that ISO does. You certainly, in your characterization of ISO, described one of the things we've done for a while, which is furnishing advisory prospective loss costs. The types of solutions I work on, which utilize predictive modeling and external data, would generally be described as something that layers on top of that suite of solutions that carriers utilize.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's similar in nature to what ISO has historically done, but it's taking an alternative approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, and my own view of the progression of data analytics is that actually I think of insurance companies as or put it a bit differently, I think of the advent of predictive modeling and, you know, these very complicated rating plans for auto or homeowners or some personalized product and for life insurance perhaps are actually using a lot more than just loss cost data. And so there, at some margin, the business is kind of moving away from ISO's core product suite because once upon a time, you could get the loss cost by line of business. And that was an interesting leveling playing field for the insurance business because you could think of the top three carriers as having kind of all the data, not sharing it with anybody, and nobody else has any idea how to make money in these lines of business. But ISO provided this interesting ability for the insurance business to bring in new entrants, so increasing competitive pressure on the larger incumbents. And that I think of as being diluted a little bit because if you have all these other variables which are all sitting within a large insurance company, you can't just license or you can't license Travelers data, right? Because Travelers got it and they ain't giving it to anybody else. And so there's a kind of trend towards bigger companies because they can aggregate bigger amounts of data and they won't share it with anybody. And so there's like this reduction in the competitive pressure on the insurance business. This is highly speculative, of course, but I'm wondering what you think about that.
I think whether you're ISO or you're a larger insurance company or a smaller insurance company, if you come up with something new and innovative and substantial, you certainly would like to protect the intellectual property you developed. And mm-hmm. I think that's why when it comes to some of the predictive models we see being developed, at a minimum, you see confidentiality being procured, for instance, in interactions with regulators, according to the relative laws and statutes in those states. And that's an important thing because, like I said, if you develop something cool, you don't necessarily want that going on the public record via a publicly available rate filing.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you in some cases even see patent protections being procured over business methods, although mm-hmm. we've over time observed some publicly reported cases which suggest that perhaps business process patents may not be quite as robust as other types of patents you might see for an invention on Shark Tank or something.
Yeah, and actually that's a really interesting point, and one that I wanted to ask you about was you mentioned in the original paper you did, the one with your colleague Smolik, is that there's actually quite a lot of telematics has been patented or was patented by Progressive in the 90s, and I didn't know that. And so one of the things that puzzled me, like I have a Geico policy on my car, and I really wanted to get I drive 1 mile to the train station and back every day. And I do some a little bit more weekend driving than that, but I've had the car for a year and a half and I've filled the gas tank up 5 times. This is a small car, so it's, you know, it gets a lot of miles, and I probably have, I don't know, 1500 miles on the thing. And so I'm a great candidate for telematics, I think, right? So I barely drive it at all, and yet I can't get any kind of telematics policy, I suppose, or hardware from Geico. And I was just kind of like wondering why, and maybe this is why, maybe because of the stuff that I want, I can only get a Progressive for. And you made the point a second ago about certain kind of business processes, the patents not being as strong. How can anybody do this? Or do you know, I don't give any legal advice, but were there restrictions on who can and cannot do what with telematics?
I'm certainly not qualified to give legal advice, of course, being an actuary and not a lawyer. I would offer, when my colleague and I wrote that paper several years ago, it was predominantly secondary research. There was a little bit of primary research contained therein, but we were largely reading the same stuff everybody else was reading in Insurance Journal and PC360 and Carrier Management and all the other places you might look for market intelligence. And one of the predominant themes vis-a-vis telematics at the time was these intellectual property protections, these patents you note. Now, it was pondered at the time whether or not these would be an inhibitor of innovation. And I think as you look at the marketplace over time, you've seen more and more carriers offering programs.
Yeah.
Have you seen it go mass market? I haven't seen it personally, although I might be missing something that's going on. I still think it could. But I would offer, while I'm not privy to any of the patents that were in place at the time or are still in place, it doesn't appear evidentially to have been a significant inhibitor of innovation.
Yeah, and my thought was the reason why we don't see more of it is it just doesn't work that well relative to the cost, right? Again, there's the valuation of you have to pay for the stupid dongle in your car or you have to buy a smartphone app. I mean, there are a lot of startups out there that are trying to change that with particularly the smartphone telematics technology, and we'll hope and see, but it doesn't seem to dominate. Is there any evaluation of the market share or how big? Is there a measurement of size for, let's say, telematics or any other one of these?
I'm not aware of what the present
penetration
is for usage-based auto insurance, for instance. But, you know, you point to the cost of the technology or perhaps the accuracy of the predictions as potentially being factors that have inhibited it from going mass market. And I would offer that that may not be the predominant factor. It's difficult to attribute when there are a lot of factors conflating and leading to the space growing or not. But from my own perspective, some of the most compelling cases of telematics I've seen brought into the marketplace recently have been by insurtech companies, mm-hmm. and they've been ones geared at solving very specific problems. Solving the problem of low mileage operators in high traffic density areas being in need of a more affordable rate. Solving the problem of ride sharing operators needing a more succinct and more relevant from a coverage period perspective solution mm-hmm. to their coverage needs. So in this way, I wonder if the reason we haven't seen the penetration that perhaps was envisioned at one point isn't because we're trying to solve all the world's problems in a single stroke, when in fact there are a lot of different problems that can be solved with telematics. And if we instead just focused ourselves on designing a relatively large number of solutions that each solved a specific problem, I think that might be the point where you actually start to see that growth that was once envisioned.
And this coming back to the theme, which is emerging as a theme here, which is where does data science interact, and how does that interact with the actual profession? The data set you're looking at, and this is something that was in my mind earlier when we were talking about this, the data set you're looking at when you're saying weather data, for example, is something you work with, is very different than you have a year of premium and you had a claim on June 20th, and that way that total of that claim is the amount you have. You kind of have one data point per year per policy. And now you have these sort of continuous data sets, or in theory continuous data sets, right? How do you work with that? Do you pre-process that somehow with some kind of algorithm, and then you have another algorithm that analyzes it?
Yeah, I think it gets a little bit into models outside the actuaries area of yeah. expertise territory. But in a nutshell, I would derive working with what I'll call non-native data sources as essentially collapsing them into a single row.
Okay.
So essentially, if I'm trying to build a territory model that deploys at a zip code level or a census block level or whatever your level of geographic resolution may be, ultimately, I'm going to want my weather data or my traffic data or anything at that level of resolution. So that's going to involve collapsing perhaps 30 years of weather data into a single row by yeah. deriving a bunch of statistics to describe that data.
Okay.
It'll also involve potentially interpolating between different weather stations, none of which may actually be in the zip code you're trying to predict.
Yep.
A lot of that falls within our core expertise. Some of it doesn't. And I would offer in the latter territory, it's certainly upon us to be hitting that actual standard of practice and understand the checks we're supposed to be doing and making sure we're doing them at a minimum to ensure reasonability and consistency of data, mm-hmm. even if we're not the parties actually measuring and collecting that data as we are for premiums and losses, for instance.
But I mean, anybody can learn anything, right? And so you can be an actuary that develops an expertise in working on that data. Does that change your kind of evaluation of what should or should not be done within an actuary, or does... Because you mentioned the standard of practice, right? And the standard of practice, and I've forgotten it, you probably know it, but it has to do with certain checks you have to run on the data and do things only that you have the expertise in, you're allowed to do. But when your expertise grows outside of the actuarial profession, does it change the standard of practice, I suppose, is my question.
I would tend to offer that I think your characterization is a correct one. Generally, the majority of these analyses are within our capabilities mm-hmm. at a minimum, if not our expertise. So for instance, weather data, you know, as we're analyzing this, we may not be meteorologists, but we can draw reasonable conclusions with sure. objective data that's
well or we can go to school and become a meteorologist, yeah. perhaps, right?
Yeah.
And you can build the expertise.
For sure. Arguably unnecessary for building a territory
yeah,
model,
fair but enough.
Something you may consider if you want to get on TV.
Yeah. But I guess what the question is, you know, does it change your actuarial, I don't know, the way in which you practice actuarial science if you become an expert in weather data and you're using that in the actuarial profession?
I would offer, yes, it does in a couple of ways. One of which is, I don't think this is explicitly listed as a consideration in any actuarial standard of practice that I know of, but I think the humility to admit what you don't know and make sure you're asking the questions of the people who do know is something that perhaps we should consider listing.
That should be an actuarial standard of practice.
Yes.
That should be a life standard of practice.
But aside from that, I mean, just as you're bringing more data to bear on whatever the problem may be, and you're using techniques that are more difficult to understand, I personally, as I've experienced role evolution, which, like I said, I don't think is by any means unique. I think my role evolution is very similar to the role evolution many other actuaries have experienced over the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. As I've experienced this, I find myself going back to the standards more than I ever have before, just because there are problems I don't fully understand and I want some guidance. So something, you know, the listening audience might consider is, gosh, you know, where do I look for guidance on some of these challenging new problems? The standards are principles-based. They're very general.
Yeah.
A lot of it rings very true, and it makes sense to go back to those whenever in doubt.
Yeah.
And if you're not finding the guidance you need, then that's motivation to go to the actual standards board and say, hey, maybe we need a new standard here.
So we're almost out of time here, and I'd like to close actually on that. And you're an active volunteer within the Casualty Actuarial Society. You donate a lot of your time towards that. In actuaries, at least within the profession, we talk about it that there's a pretty high rate of people that do things. I think it's a third of actuaries all volunteer that some of their time. Maybe I'll count this podcast as my volunteering time. Why don't more people do it? You know, going to the Actuarial Standards Board seems to me to be an extraordinary thing to do, but people do it, and there's a lot of activity. If you look at the request for kind of commentary on new standards that they want to put out or some revision, I mean, you get a lot of people commenting on that. What got you into that? It's given a lot of satisfaction to you, I'm sure. Maybe you can maybe close on some thoughts on inspire younger actuaries or non-participating actuaries to join in.
Yeah, I think the podcast is a tremendous example of actuarial volunteerism. I've listened to them. I find them tremendously enriching. I think that's the sort of thing more and more people should be doing. I mean, as for my own volunteer activities, I got involved with it just because I want to meet people and gain access to challenges I might not have access to in my individual role. As I mentioned, I personally have not done anything of substance in the microinsurance arena, but microinsurance was something that fascinated me, and I wanted to meet people who were doing this. And participating in a CAS working party on microinsurance gave me firsthand access to people who were doing this for a living, and I learned so much from them, not just about microinsurance, which I've yet to practice, but also common sense techniques that I might bring back to my everyday practice. So for folks who maybe are on the fence about whether or not to volunteer with, I would offer probably the leading barrier being lack of time. I would offer, start a working party, start a task force, get a couple of people together on something you're passionate about, and build a plan that isn't that time consuming.
Hmm.
And once you've done that and you're executing with your colleagues, you're going to learn a lot and you're going to make an impact. No CAS working party, no task force is going to solve all the world's problems in a single stroke, because the problem will be too big and we don't have time to do it because we all have day jobs. But if you find small, manageable problems that you want to get together to solve, then you're going to make a big impact. And you said you get a lot of satisfaction out of the podcast. I get a lot of satisfaction out of my volunteerism, something everybody should do, in my opinion.
And where can they go if they want to do that? Where do they go?
If you go to the CAS website, you can find probably about 500 different volunteer activities you can gain access to, probably about 100 of which are still live and the others of which have atrophied or discontinued for whatever reason. I'd say that's one source. But the other, I would say, is just go to a regional affiliate meeting in your area. David, I know you're involved in two sessions at the upcoming Casualty Actuaries of Greater New York meeting.
That's right.
So you can meet a lot of people there. You can meet David. You can meet me. And there, you can actually talk to people about some of the volunteerism they're doing and see how you can get involved. So I think that's a great first step.
It'll be May 25th at the New Yorker Hotel.
24th, yeah.
24th, right. My guest today is Jim Weiss. Jim, thank you very much for joining the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.